ignored it.
I'd learned since high school that in an emergency, shyness can be disguised with a completely fake bravado. You tried to run me down, Lloyd. I ought to turn you in for reckless driving. I ran my fingers through my hair. Actually, I didn't think you'd know who I was. Are you kidding? How many beautiful 6-foot-tall women you think we've got in this town? 5'11", I corrected. I'm the shorter of the Beanpole sisters. I felt suddenly drunk, though I wasn't, chemically speaking. Trish drifted off toward the barbecue pit. He looked at me for a long time, just looked, grinning. His left hand was fingering the tip of an olive branch, and I expected him to snap it off, but he didn't. He only took in its texture as someone might eat chocolate or inhale a cigarette. "You want another beer?" he asked. So that was going to be it. No filling in the last 15 years, no constructing ourselves for each other, otherwise known as falling in love. I asked him, "Think you can get over to that ice chest and back before this party is over?" I knew he wouldn't. "In case I don't, I've got your phone number," he winked. "Don't you worry, you'll be hearing from my lawyer." I felt adrift and disappointed, though I hadn't held any conscious expectations of Lloyd. I looked around at other faces, wondering if they all held secret disappointments for me. Doña Altea, the ancient woman we used to call the Peacock Lady, was holding court in a lawn chair under the fig tree. She was the one who used to collect the feathers for the piñatas. She looked today like she always had, dressed in black, fierce and miniature, like a frightening breed of small dog. Even with her braided crown of silver hair, she wasn't 5 feet tall. JT's mother, Viola Domingos, and several other women sat in a group with her, fanning themselves in time to the music and drinking beer. JT and Lloyd had apparently been commandeered into serving them food. The goat had been pronounced done. People were beginning to move toward the makeshift table, which I'd helped Emelina improvise from the doors to Mason's and the twins' rooms, covered with embroidered tablecloths, compliments of the Stitch and Bitch Club. There was enough food to save an African nation. Potato salad, deviled eggs, menudo, tortillas and refried beans and 1,000 kinds of dessert. I heard somebody say in a high-pitched voice, "Tomato soup in that cake? I wouldn't have guessed that for love nor money." I wasn't in any hurry. I moved out of the way of the principal rush and stood near the gate to the side yard near my little house. I noticed a dog lying very still and alert just on the other side of the gate. It looked like an oversized coyote, but it was definitely a domestic creature. It had a green bandana tied around its neck. This dog didn't belong to Emelina's household. I was pretty sure I knew all the family animals. It sat with its mouth slightly open and its ears cocked, staring steadily through the wire gate at the people inside. "You thinking about crashing this party?" I asked the dog. It glanced up at me for a second with a patient look, then fixed its gaze back on the crowd, or maybe on the roast goat. "I'll bring you some of that if you're willing to wait a while," I said. "Nobody's gonna miss one little bite." The dog didn't respond to this promise. All the old men had served themselves first and were settling down into a huddle of folding chairs near the front door of my cottage, holding their plates carefully horizontal above their knees. I started to move away out of deference, but I noticed they were talking about fruit drop. I plainly heard one of them say the words poison ground. I stood 4 feet away and invisible, I suppose because they were men, and women talked to women. They asked questions of each other, to which they apparently already knew the answers. "Do you know how much sulfuric they put in the river? He said the EPA give Black Mountain 30 days to shut down that leaching operation." "Damn, man, that's veneno. How long you think we've been putting that on our trees?" "When did anybody ever tell the mountain what to do?" The man who said this had a remarkably wrinkled brown face, like an Indian mummy I'd seen once in a roadside museum. "They'll pull some kind of strings," he said. A man who sat with his back to me spoke up. They won't fight the EPA. It's not worth it. They've been saying for 10 years that mine is dead. They're not hardly getting anything from that leaching operation. Another man nodded at this, pointing his fork toward the head of the canyon. Just enough to pay the taxes, that's all. They'll shut her down. You think so? Asked the one who reminded me of a mummy. They're getting gold and moly out of them tailing piles. If they wasn't, they wouldn't keep running the acid through them. You boys know that damn company. They're not going to stop no leaching operation on account of our pecan trees. His voice trailed off and he was quiet for a minute, his calloused fingers fooling with an unlit cigarette. I heard women's voices rising randomly over the din of the party, calling out instructions, reining in their kids. The party seemed like something underwater, a lost continent, and I felt profoundly sad, though it wasn't my continent. I would go get a bite to eat, say something grateful to Emelina, and slip back into my house. The man with his back to me said, "It's in Ray Pilar's apples in Queens." He pronounced it Queens. Another man, younger than the others, said, "It's going to kill every damn tree in this canyon. If I'm wrong, my friend, you can shoot me." The man with the wrinkled face said, "If you're right, my friend, you might as well shoot yourself." Chapter 8. Pictures. The dead mountain range of tailings on the lip of the mine had sat for decades, washed by rain, and still was barren as the Sahara. From a distance, you might guess these piles of dirt to be fragile, like a sand castle, but up close, you'd see the pinkish soil corrugated with vertical ridges and eroded to a sheen like rock. It would take a pickaxe to dent it. It was high noon, and I knew where I was. I bypassed the old mine road at the top of the canyon and stayed on the unmarked lane that people called, for reasons unknown to me, the Old Pony Road. All Grace's streets went by odd names that mostly had to do with picturesque forms of transportation. The Old and New Pony Roads, the Goat Leg, Dog Cart Road, and the inexplicable Tortoise Road. Amazingly, most or all of these also had official normal-sounding names like West Street and San Francisco Lane, which were plainly marked on painted aluminum street signs and totally ignored. Maybe somebody had just recently dreamed up these normal names and hammered up signs to improve the town's image. From the canyon's crest, I could see down into the isolated settlements at the north end of the valley, some abandoned, some buried in deep graves of mine tailings, through which, presumably, Black Mountain now ran quantities of sulfuric acid. Far to the south lay open desert. The road I was on would pass through one more flock of little houses, all settled like hens into their gardens, before reaching Doc Homer's drafty two-story gray edifice. I bypassed the main entrance of the hospital, the only one of the ghost town of Black Mountain buildings that was still in use. The hospital itself had finally closed. People had to leave Grace for a more equipped town if their problems were major. But Doc Homer's office in the basement could handle anything up to and including broken limbs. He wasn't working there today. I'd called him at home. I was expected.
"Cosima! Cosima Nolene! I want you to look!"
A heavy-set woman in a house dress and running shoes was standing at her mailbox shouting at me,
"Child, will you look if you aren't the picture of your mother?"
My mother was dead at my age. The woman put her arms around me. She was nobody I recognized.
"We've been so anxious to see you," she said at a convincing decibel level. "Viola told us at sewing club you'd got in and was staying down with her and JT and Emelina till you can help Doc get his place straightened out and move in up here with him. Oh, I know Doc's glad to have you back. He's been poorly. I don't expect he'd tell you, but he is. They said when you was overseas you learned the cure they used on that actress in Paris, France. Bless your heart. You're a dear child." She paused, finally, taking in my face. "You don't remember me, do you?"
I waited, expecting help. It had been 14 years, after all, but she offered no hints. "No, I'm sorry," I said. "I don't."
"Yuda,"
the woman said. "Oh, Yuda, I'm sorry." I still didn't have the foggiest idea who she was.
"I won't keep you, hon, but I want you to come for dinner soon as you can. I've baked Doc a squash pie I've been aiming to take up there. Hang on, I'll just run get it."
I waited while she hurried on her small feet up the path to the house and disappeared into the cave of honeysuckle that had swallowed her front porch. Yuda returned directly with a covered pie tin that I accepted, along with a bewildering kiss on both cheeks. I wondered how many people in Grace believed I'd flown in fresh from Paris with a cure for Alzheimer's. He'd told me 2 years ago. I had no idea if it was the confirmed truth or just his opinion, since Doc Homer made no distinction between the two. And if it was true, I still didn't know what to think. What we are talking about, basically, is self-diagnosed insanity, and that gets complicated. Carlo and I, in fact, weren't living in Paris, we never had, but in Minnesota. We'd already come back from Crete. Hallie had kept decently in touch with Doc Homer, but I hadn't and felt guilty, so I engineered a visit in Las Cruces. God knows how long he would have waited to tell me otherwise. This meeting was not a plan he'd cooked up to give me the news, but my idea sprung at the last minute. An accident of science, actually. Someone had recently spliced the glow gene from a glowworm into a tobacco plant, and the scientific world was buzzing over this useless but remarkable fact. All the top geneticists were meeting in New Mexico, and my boss wanted me down there to take notes. I was working at a high-powered research lab. This was prior to my moving back to Tucson and falling into convenience mart clerking. If I ever wrote down on paper my full employment history, I assure you, it would look like the resume of a schizophrenic. And in my professional upswings, I had more of what passes for confidence. It dawned on me that it's an easy bus ride over the state line from Grace to Las Cruces. I'd phone Doc Homer. I was astonished when he agreed to come. "Barring unforeseen difficulties at the hospital," he'd said over the phone. I didn't know yet that the hospital had closed, that he sometimes forgot. "You always say that," I told him. It was true. That was his standard disclaimer on every promise to Hallie or me, but it was uncharacteristic for me to tease him. Truthfully, after such an ice age, there was no such thing as characteristic. I tried out joking, more or less, to see if it would work. "You'll say that at your own funeral, Pop," I'd said boldly into the receiver. Later, after he told me, I could have bitten my tongue off for that. We met in the lobby of the Holiday Inn, just for a couple of drinks, since he said he had to get back to Grace that night. The bar was done up in this madly cheerful south-of-the-border decor, with a blue-tile fountain and silk bougainvilleas climbing out of clay pots shaped like pigs. It was somebody's idea of what old Mexico would look like if you didn't have to take poverty into account. The waitresses wore swishy miniskirts with ruffles in contrasting primary colors. In this setting, my father told me he had a terminal disorder of the brain. All I kept thinking was that he must be wrong. I doubted he'd had a CAT scan. The thing to do would be to check into the university hospital in Tucson and get a neurological workup to rule out other things, but I didn't try to talk him into it. The nature of my relationship with Doc Homer, which had eluded me over the phone, came back instantly when I saw him. There are all the small things you love and despise about a parent. The disappointed eyes, the mannerisms, the sound of the voice as much as the meaning of the words, that add up to that singular thing, the way you are both going to respond, whether you like it or not. It had settled heavily over our table, and I could hardly breathe. I knew this man. He wouldn't seek out a second opinion to stack up against his own. He'd suffer his own doubts, but never anyone else's. The waitress swished over and brought us fresh margaritas. The trickle of the fountain put me on edge, the way a running toilet will, or any sound of water going to waste. "What are you going to do?" I asked Doc Homer. "I don't see a need to do anything special for the time being. I'll make arrangements when the time comes." My stomach was tight. I felt perversely annoyed with the smiling clay pigs. I touched my lips to the coarse salt on the rim of the margarita glass, and the crystals felt like sand in my mouth or broken glass. I thought of walls I'd seen in Mexico, high brick hacienda walls topped with a crest of broken bottles embedded in cement to keep people on their correct sides of the fence. If they wanted to provide an authentic Mexican flavor, they should have something like that in here, I thought. "Nobody else knows," he said, "and I'd like for you not to mention it to your sister." I stared at him. I knew it wouldn't matter what came next, whether I said, "Okay," or "Why," or "That's not fair," which is what I mainly felt. Dr. Homer Nolene had stopped talking, there being nothing more to say in his opinion. I imagined him going back to Grace on the bus and lying that night in his bed, tired but wide awake, recalling the events of his day and wondering what pathways of thought in his brain might be slipping off track, trying to remember what vegetable he'd cooked for dinner or what tie he'd worn. He might be confronting these thoughts with fear or only clinical interest. I really didn't know. For the first time in my life then, and just for a few seconds, I was able to see Doc Homer as someone I felt sorry for. It was a turning point for me. One of those instants of freakishly clear sight when you understand that your parent might have taken entirely the wrong road in life, even if that road includes your own existence. I pitied Doc Homer for his slavish self-sufficiency, for standing Hallie and me in the kitchen and inspecting us like a general, not for crooked hems so much as for signs of the weaknesses of our age, the lipstick hidden in a book satchel, the smoldering wish to be like everyone else. Being like no one else, being alone, was the central ethic of his life. Mine too, to some extent, not by choice but by default. My father, the only real candidate for center of my universe, was content to sail his private sea and leave me on my own. I still held that against him. I hadn't thought before about how self-sufficiency could turn on you in old age or sickness. The captain was going down with his ship. He was just a man becoming a child. It became possible for me to go back to Grace. I arrived at the house, nervous, ludicrously armed with Yuta's squash pie. But he was in his dark room, not waiting. He called it his workroom, I think to try to legitimize his hobby to himself. Doc Homer made pictures. Specifically, he made photographs of things that didn't look like what they actually were. He had hundreds. Clouds that looked like animals. Landscapes that looked like clouds. They were pressed between slabs of cardboard in closets. Only one was framed. The matting and framing were my present to him one Christmas when I was in high school, after I'd started making my own money. It had cost me a lot and was a mistake. His hobby was a private thing, too frivolous, in his opinion, to be put on public display. I should have foreseen this, but didn't. Nevertheless, he'd hung it in the kitchen, God only knows why, because the man was far from sentimental, and there it still hung. It was the first thing I noticed when I knocked on the screen door and walked in. The photo was my favorite, a hand on a white table. And of course, it wasn't a hand, but a clump of 5 saguaro cacti, oddly curved and bumpy, shot against a clear sky, all turned sideways. Odd as it seemed, this thing he did, there was a great deal of art to it. I put the pie in the refrigerator and nosed around a little, telling myself it's what a good daughter would do. I pictured these good daughters, wifely and practical, wearing perms and loafers and Peter Pan collars. I didn't remotely look the part. As I crept around the house, it felt to me like a great, sad, recently disclosed secret. The kitchen seemed smaller than when I was a girl, standing on a bucket to reach the sink, but that's natural. It was also crowded with odds and ends you wouldn't expect in a kitchen. A pair of Piper forceps, for example, washed with the day's dishes and sitting amongst them on the drain board. This didn't signify any new eccentricity on his part. He'd always had a bizarre sense of utility. I could picture him using the forceps to deliver a head of cabbage from a pot of boiling water, holding it up, not in a show-off way, but proud he'd thought of it, as if he were part of a very small club of people who had the brains to put obstetrical instruments to use in the kitchen. The rooms were cool and stale, although it was hot outside. I stepped through the living room, over the old Turkish carpet, which looked malnourished, its bare white threads exposed like ribs. "Doc Homer could afford better," I heard somebody say in my mind, a voice I couldn't identify. "All the money he's got up there." Which, of course, wasn't true. We never had much. That was just what people thought because we were standoffish. Beyond the living room was the parlor where he used to see patients who'd come to the house, embarrassed, it seems to me now, at night when the office was closed. At present, the parlor was shockingly cramped. The door to the outside porch was blocked by furniture I didn't remember, two sofas and something that looked like a cobbler's bench. Folded on a sofa was one thing I remembered well, a black crocheted afghan with red flowers. Hallie and I used to drag that thing around everywhere, our totem against disaster. It looked cleaner now than I'd ever seen it. Magazines and journals were everywhere. His American Journal of Genetics was still organized chronologically on the shelf. That was his pet interest. They'd once published his article on the greatly inbred gene pool of Grace with its marble-eyed babies. He'd even rigged up a system for photographing the newborn's eyes for documentation. The trait first began showing up in the 50s when third cousin descendants of the Gracela sisters started marrying each other. Emelina would have been one of his subjects. You needed to get the gene from both sides. It was recessive. That's about what I knew. For me, it was enough to understand that everyone in Grace was somehow related, except us Nolines, the fish out of water. Our gene pool was back in Illinois. Other magazines, many in number, were piled on the floor. I picked up a Lancet, 1977, my first year of med school. There was an important article on diabetes I remembered. Underneath, a recent National Geographic. There was no order at all. Though, if I mentioned it, he'd come up with some elaborate rationale before he'd admit to disorganization. South Sea Islands and Islets of Langerhans, I could see him saying, and not meaning it as a joke. The smell of mold was making my eyes water. I was inclined toward the stairs to go up and see what kind of shape the bedrooms were in, but I didn't have the heart. It wasn't my house. I forced my hand to knock on the darkroom door. "Open. I'm about to start printing." I closed the door behind me. There was only a dim red light bulb. "Hi, Pop," I said. He looked at me, unsurprised, and not very much changed, I could see as my eyes adjusted. I was prepared for frailty and incoherence, but he was lucid and familiar. The same substantial hands and wrist bones, the straight nose and low, broad mouth, things I also have, without noticing much. He motioned for me to sit. "So how are you these days?" I asked. He ignored the question. We hadn't been together since the Holiday Inn lounge 2 years ago, but from Doc Homer, you didn't expect hugs and kisses. He was legendary in this regard. Hallie and I used to play a game we called Orphans when we were with him in a crowd. Who in this room is our true father or mother, we would ask. Which is the one grown up here that loves us? We'd watch for a sign, a solicitous glance, a compliment, someone who might even kneel down and straighten Hallie's hair ribbon, which we'd tugged out of alignment as bait. That person would never be Doc Homer, proving to us, of course, that he wasn't the one grown up there who loved us. I sat carefully on a cool file cabinet. He was adjusting black knobs on the enlarger, preparing to make a print. When he switched on the bulb, an image appeared against the wall in reverse. White trees, black sky, mottled foreground. I'd learned how to look at negatives many years before I read my first X-ray. He shrank the frame into focus, shut it off while he slid a rectangle of paper into place and set the timer, and then projected the picture again, burning it into the paper. In the center were two old men hunched on a stone wall, backs to the camera. They look like rocks, I said. It's hard to see where the wall ends and the men start. Men who look like stones, said Doc Homer. His speech was more formal than most people's writing. Who else would really say stones? Except for the hat, I said. That hat's a giveaway. I'm taking it out. He held a small steel spatula into the beam of light and waved little circles over the area of the man's hat as if he were rubbing it out, which is exactly what he was doing. Photographers call this dodging, and the spatula was a dodging tool, though in all probability this one was something used in gallbladder surgery. When I was little, I called it the magic wand. The timer rang, and he shut the projector off. I looked at his face in profile in the faint red light. Deep lines ran from his nose to the corners of his mouth. He didn't look well, but maybe he never had. He picked up the print by its edges. You haven't heard anything from Hallie, have you? He shook his head. You're sure you don't want me to tell her you've got... that you're sick? I'm sorry to bring this up, but it's hard to be the only one. I think she'd want to know. He appeared not to have heard me. I knew he had. Doc Homer never argued. He just didn't participate in conversation that didn't please him. So, did the man's hat go away? I asked. He slipped the paper into a dishpan of clear liquid. We'll see. He seemed suddenly happy now, almost friendly, as he often did in here. The dark room was the nearest I'd ever come to feeling like I had a dad. We stood without talking and watched a gray image grow on the paper like some fungus with a mind of its own. I thought about the complex chemistry of vision, remembering from medical school the textbook diagrams of an image projected through the eyeball, temporarily inscribed on the retina. I never thought about how printing a photograph duplicates eyesight, I said. It's the same exact process in slow motion. He nodded appreciatively, and my heart warmed. I'd pleased him. Probably, he said, there is no real invention in the modern world. Just a good deal of elaboration on nature. He lifted out the slick print and slipped it into a second tray, the fixer. The stone has no head, he pronounced correctly. It looked like a rock wall with two extra rocks balanced on top. You'd think it was just a simple snapshot of what it looked like. His finest art defeated itself. God only knows what was the point, but it made him smile. When the timer rang again, he took the photograph out and slid it into its final bath. He fished out several other prints and attached them with small clothespins to a wire. Then he dried his hands on a towel, one finger at a time. These gestures made me think of all the years he'd spent alone, doing his own dishes, his laundry. I felt our visit drawing to a close, like a scientifically predicted death. We would go out into the light, find a little more to say, and then I'd go. There's a pie for you in the kitchen, I said. From Yuda. Who is she? Yuda Ruth Dell, he said, as though that explained it. I mean, what is she to me? Did I used to know her?
Not especially, said Doc Homer, still studying the photographs. No better than you knew anyone else.
She knows all about me and then some, I said. She probably knows what I had for lunch.
You're in grace, he said.
Well, I was embarrassed because I couldn't remember her. She wasn't very helpful. She just stood there waiting for me to rack my brain and come up with her name. She sure knew me right off the bat.
Doc Homer didn't care for expressions like right off the bat. He switched off the red light before opening the darkroom door, passing us through a moment of absolute darkness. He knew, but refused to accept, that I was afraid of the dark. The click and blackness plunged me into panic, and I grabbed his upper arm. Surprisingly, he touched my knuckles lightly with his fingertips.
You're in grace, he said again, as if nothing had happened. There was only one of you for all these people to be watching for, and so many of them for you. I'd lived all my life with a recurring nightmare. It would come to me in that drowsy twilight where sleep pulls on your mind with tempting music but is still preventable. When I let down my guard, the dream would spring again, sending me back into weeks of insomnia. It had to do with losing my eyesight. It wasn't a complicated dream like a movie, but a single paralyzing freeze frame. There's a shattering pop, like glass breaking, and then I am blind. Once, years ago on Crete, Carlo and I were driving on a badly rutted gravel road to get to a beach on the south of the island. A truck loaded with blood oranges kicked up a rock that broke the windshield in front of my face. I wasn't hurt. The rock only pocked the glass and spun out a spiderweb of cracks, but I spent the rest of the day in mute hysteria. Carlo never did know what was wrong. Any explanation I could think of sounded like superstition. My dream was very much more than a dream. It had so much living weight to it, such prescience. It felt like something that was someday bound to happen. The insomnia, on the other hand, wasn't such a big problem as you might imagine. I worked around it. I read a lot. In med school, I did my best studying while my classmates were in the throes of rapid eye movement. I still considered my night-prowling habits to be a kind of secret advantage I had over other people. I had the extra hours in my day that they were always wishing for. Emelina would not understand this. The night before school started, she brought me warm milk. "Don't worry about it," I said. She had also brought out a blue-embroidered tablecloth, which she shook out like a little sail and spread efficiently over my table. She felt the place needed more homey touches. "You've got to have your sleep. They had a special on Nova about it. This man in Italy died from not sleeping for around 8 months. Before he died, he went crazy. He'd salute the doctors like he was in the army." "Em, I'll live. That's too pretty, that tablecloth. Don't you need that?"
"Are you kidding? Since Grammy joined Stitch and Bitch, she's been embroidering borders on the dish rags.
What happens if you just lie in bed and count backward from 99? That's what I tell the boys to do when they can't settle down."
"Insomnia's different," I said. It was hard to explain this to people.
"You know the light that comes on when you open the refrigerator door? Just imagine it stays on all the time, even after you close the door. That's what it's like in my head. The light stays on." Emelina made herself comfortable in my other living room chair.
"You're like that Thoreau guy that lived at Walden Pond. Remember when we read that in senior English? He only had 2 chairs. We need to get you some more stuff in here."
I was surprised that Henry Thoreau entered into Emelina's worldview.
"If I want company, I can always go over to your house," I pointed out.
"That's the God's truth. I'm about ready to move out. Tonight, Glenn and Grammy got into it. Oh, boy, she says he's impudent. That's her all-time favorite word. Whenever Mason gets mad at somebody now, he yells, 'You're impotent!' And people laugh, so we'll never get him to stop now."
I drank the milk. I could stand some mothering.
I wondered if I'd had this in the back of my mind when I moved in here. Emelina scrutinized my clean white walls. Cody, I hope you'll take this the right way, but I don't see how you can live in a place and have it feel like nobody lives there. I have things in here. My clothes, look in the closet. And books. Some of those books are very personal. This was true. Besides my field guide to the invertebrates, there were things Hallie had sent me over the years, and an old volume of American poetry, incomprehensibly a graduation gift from Doc Homer. Your room was like this when we were in high school. I had posters of Paul Revere and the Raiders and dead corsages stuck in the mirror, every kind of junk. And when we'd go over to your house, it was like a room somebody just moved out of. I'm neat, I said. It's not neat. It's hyper neat. Can you imagine what Doc Homer would have said if Paul Revere and the Raiders turned up in his home without an appointment? She laughed. Emelina, who's you to Ruth Dell? Well, you know her. She lives up by Doc Homer. She used to take care of you sometimes, I think. Her and that other woman that's dead now. I think her name was Naomi. She used to take care of us? I'd been trying all day to place her. I couldn't believe I'd draw a complete blank on someone who'd been a fixture of my childhood. Sure, Yuda's husband Eddie saved you and Hallie's life that time when you got stranded in a storm down by the creek. I don't have any idea what you're talking about. Yes, you do. When you and Hallie almost drowned in that flood, you were just little. Well, how do you remember it then? I don't. Everybody knew about that. It was a famous incident. You hid down in a coyote burrow and wouldn't come out, and Eddie Dell found you and drug you out. You all stayed at Yuda's. Doc Homer must have been working at the hospital or something. I don't remember anything about that. Emelina looked at me peculiarly, as if she thought I might be pulling her leg. It was a real big deal. There was a picture in the paper of you two and Eddie, the big hero, and his mule. I guess I do remember, I said, but I didn't, and it bothered me that my childhood was everyone's property but my own. You know what you are, Cody? I don't know if there's a word for it, but it's the opposite of homemaker. I laughed. She was still distressed by my blank walls. There's a word, I said, homewrecker, but I'm not one. No, I don't mean in the sense of homewrecker. I mean in the sense of home ignorer. Oh, that way, I said. I was playing dumb. I knew what she meant. My first boyfriend in college was a Buddhist, and even he had more pictures on his wall than I did. It wasn't anything noble. I couldn't claim a disdain for worldly things. Hallie had once pointed out I had more shoes than you'd find in a Central American schoolroom with class in session. What I failed at was the activity people call nesting. For me, it never seemed like nesting season had arrived yet. Or I wasn't that kind of bird. After Emelina left for the night, I wrote Hallie. I had a general delivery address for her in Managua, and I asked, the way we did when we were kids leaving notes for each other in secret hiding places, "Are you there yet? Are you reading this now?" I told her about the dead alfalfa fields around Gracela Canyon, which I thought would interest her professionally, and I told her Doc Homer seemed pretty much the same as ever, which was the truth. And I asked if she remembered the time we almost drowned in a coyote den. Chapter 9, The Bones in God's Backyard. Grace High School, backdrop of the worst 4 years of my life, was as familiar as one of my bad dreams. Walking toward it up Prosper Street filled me with dread. The building itself had a lot of charm, though, which surprised me. As a child, I'd paid no mind to the facade. It was a WPA-era building made of Gracela Canyon's red granite, with ornate Eggendorf moldings on the white-painted eaves and woodwork over the doors. The school was actually built by the mining company in its boom years, and with minorly instincts, or possibly just the proper tools, it was built right into the steep side of the canyon, sunk into rock. It was in an old part of town where the cobbled streets wrapped up and around behind the buildings, occasionally breaking into flights of steps, and elsewhere so steep as to make motor vehicles pointless. The principal form of exercise in Grace was just getting from your house to wherever you needed to go. The school had 4 floors, and each one had a street-level entrance. I'm pretty sure the building was in some record book on account of this. The main entrance was on the side, halfway up the hill, floor 3. Carved into its granite arch was a grammatically suspect motto in Latin, causam meam cognosco, which boys used to quote like pig Latin or the inane Indian talk we heard in movies. I checked into the principal's office where his secretary, Anita, gave me a set of keys and an armload of official-looking papers and cheered me on. There's a million forms there, grade forms, class roster, some new thing from the DES and your CTA. It all has to be filled out. What? You mean I have to work for a living here? Somebody told me teaching high school was easy money. I looked through the stack of forms. What about DOA? I may need one of those. Anita looked at me oddly for half a second, then laughed. We'll just call the coroner when they bring you in. I smiled. Doc Homer was the coroner of Grace, and had been for the entirety of my life and then some. Obviously, Anita didn't know who I was. She looked like a recent graduate herself. Anyone in high school now would have been a toddler when I left Grace. This filled me with hope. Walking those wainscoted halls, still painted in the exact same shade of toothpaste green, made me shrink into my skin, and I had to keep reminding myself, none of them knows you as Doc Homer's misfit child. No one here has seen you in orthopedic shoes. The kids will just love you, Anita said, surprising me. They're not used to anybody, so... She paused, tapping a complete set of maroon fingernails on her metal desk and presumably fishing for a tactful adjective. So contemporary. I was wearing a dark green blazer, tight jeans, and purple cowboy boots. I ran a hand through my hair and wondered if I should have paid a call to the Hollywood shop after all. Do you think I'm not enough of an authority figure? Will they revolt? The teachers' meeting 2 days prior had been devoted primarily to theories of discipline. Anita laughed. No way. They know who turns in the grades. I found the room where I would be teaching general biology 1 and 2 and made it through the homeroom period by taking attendance and appearing preoccupied. I'd finally paid my preparatory visit to the school a few days earlier, so I knew what to expect in the way of equipment, desks and chairs, some stone-topped lab benches with sinks and arched chrome faucets, an emergency shower, a long glass case containing butterflies and many other insects in ill repair, and a closet full of dissecting pans and arcane audiovisual aids. The quaint provisions led me to expect I'd be working in something like a museum or a British movie. When the kids filled the room for first period, though, they gave it a different slant. So far in Grace, I hadn't seen a lot of full-blown teenagers. I wasn't expecting skateboard haircuts. The girls seemed to feel a little sorry for me as I stood up there brushing chalk dust off my blazer and explaining what I intended for us to do in the coming year. But the boys sat with their enormous high-top sneakers splayed out into the aisles, their arms crossed, and their bangs in their eyes, looking at me like exactly what I was, one of the last annoying things standing between them and certified adulthood. You can call me Cody, I said, though I'd been warned against this. Ms. Nolene sounds too weird. I went to this high school and had biology in this room, and I don't really feel that old. I guess to you that sounds like a joke. To you, I'm the wicked old witch of life science. This got a very slight rise out of the boys, not exactly a laugh. The girls looked embarrassed. A tall boy wearing a Motley Crue t-shirt and what looked like a 5 o'clock shadow on his scalp pulled a cigarette out of his pocket and thumped it against his knuckles. I was told we'd need an authority figure in the classroom, I said, so I dug one up. I went to the closet and wheeled out a human skeleton. This is Mrs. Josephine Nash. I'd found her downstairs in a storage room filled with damaged field hockey equipment and gym uniforms from the 50s. The skeleton was in pretty good shape. I'd only had to reattach one elbow with piano wire and duct tape provided by the janitor. The name, along with an address in Franklin, Illinois, was written in fine antique-looking letters on the flange of her pelvis. When I discovered her in the storage room, I felt moved to dust her off and hang her up on the heavy cast-iron stand and wheel her up to my lab. I guess I was somewhat desperate for companionship. "Miss," one of the boys said. "Miss Cody?" I tried not to smile. "Yes?" "That's Mr. Bad Bones." He enunciated the name in a way that made everybody laugh. "The seniors use him for the Halloween dance." "Well, not anymore," I said. Mrs. Nash was my compatriot from the Midwest, a possible relative even. I could see her as somebody's mother out pruning roses. "This isn't a toy," I said, my voice shaking slightly. "It's the articulated skeleton of a human being who was at one time, fairly recently, walking around alive. Her name was Josephine Nash, and she lived in Illinois, and it's time she got some respect in her retirement." I glared at them. Teenagers are so attached to their immortality. "You never know where you're going to end up in this world, do you?" I asked. 19 pairs of blank, mostly pale blue eyes looked back at me. You could have heard a cigarette drop. "Okay," I said. "Chapter 1, Matter, Energy, Organization, and Life." "I don't know if I'm going to live through this," I told Emelina, collapsing in her kitchen. Her kitchen chairs were equipales that took you in like a hug, which I needed. My first day had gone as smoothly as anybody could reasonably hope. No revolts, no crises, major or minor. Still, I couldn't put a finger on what it was, but standing in front of a room full of high school students seemed to use up a ferocious amount of energy. It made me think of those dancers in white boots and miniskirts who used to work bars in the 60s, trying desperately to entertain, flailing around like there was no tomorrow. Emelina, Mason, the baby, and I were all exiled to the kitchen. Viola had taken over the living room with her friends for a special afternoon meeting of the Stitch and Bitch Club. They were preparing for their annual fundraising bazaar, and as a backdrop to our own conversation, we could overhear the exchange of presumably vital information. "Last year, the hospital equipment company didn't make 15 cents on them sachet cushions." "Well, it's no wonder they stunk. Lalo saw in a magazine where you can make airplanes out of cut beer cans. The propellers go around." Emelina set a cup of tea in front of me. I picked it up and let the steam touch my eyelids, realizing that what I needed most at that moment was to lie in bed with someone who was fond of every inch of my skin. "It must be weird going back to that school," she said. "Oh, sure, it is." I didn't let myself think too much about that part of the job till today. Mason was on the floor coloring, and Emelina was moving around the kitchen in an effortless frenzy, closing drawers with her hip, cooking dinner, and feeding the baby at the same time. "Let me do that," I said, scooting myself over to the high chair and taking the cereal bowl from Emelina. "Here, he makes a pretty fair mess. Let me give you Grammy's apron," she said, tying around me a splendid example of Stitch and Bitch enterprise. The baby snapped up cereal as fast as I could spoon it in, wasting little on mess as far as I could see. "You're having dinner with us tonight, right?" "No, thanks," I said. "Honestly, Cody, if you think one more mouth to feed is any trouble, you're out of your mind. If I woke up one day and had 6 more kids, I don't think I'd notice." "No, Em, thanks, but I feel like resting in peace." "You're not dead yet, hon." From the living room, we heard Viola raising her voice now in Spanish, saying something about peacocks, pavones. The other women answered in Spanish, and I could follow just enough to know that they'd moved rapidly onto the subject of fruit trees. Doña Altea sounded agitated. Her high-pitched voice was easy to recognize, exactly what you'd expect from a very small, strong-willed woman. And Melina raised her eyebrows as she looked under a pot lid.
Do you know the boys won't even speak Spanish to their Grammy?
She asked in a subdued voice. I glanced at Mason, who was absorbed in his coloring book, though probably listening. Is that a problem?
Oh, yeah. Viola's big on all the traditional stuff. She's real tight with Doña Altea. She wants us to raise the boys puro, speaking Spanish and knowing all the stories. Seems like it might be easier with girls, but these guys...
She shrugged her shoulders.
My parents were always so modern. You remember how Mom is. Electric can openers all the way. I always felt like she wanted me to grow up blonde, you know? My dad told me she actually wanted to name me Gidget.
I laughed.
No, he was pulling your leg. No, he wasn't. And poor Tucker was named after a car.
Tucker was a younger brother who died in infancy, before I ever knew the family. To tell the truth, I'd forgotten him, in spite of his name passed on to Emelina's first son. The baby was sitting with his mouth opened unbelievably wide, waiting for my attention to return to his dinner. I poked in the next bite. A scattering of loud laughter like a rainstorm came from the other room, and all of us in the kitchen were quiet. This gang of old women staked out such a presence, we felt almost crowded out of the house. Mason actually gathered up his papers and started to go outside. Emelina called him back.
Wait a minute, Mason, before you run off, come show Cody your hand. Cody, could you take a look at his hand? There's some kind of bump on it. Do you mind?
Why would I mind? Let's have a look. I felt uncomfortable, not because she'd asked, but with myself, playing doctor. I was a doctor, technically, which is to say I had the training, but it unnerved me to think people saw me in that role. Both Emelina and Mason were quiet while I examined his hand. I bent the wrist back and forth and felt the lump on the tendon.
It's a ganglion, I said.
Is that bad? Emelina asked.
No, it's not serious at all, just a little bump.
Usually they go away on their own. Does it hurt, Mason? He shook his head.
Only when he has chores to do, Emelina offered.
I put a kiss on my fingertips and rubbed it into his wrist. There you go, Dr. Cody's special cure. As he ran off, it occurred to me with a certain self-punitive malice that this was the extent of special curing I was licensed to dispense.
So what's it like up there at the high school? Emelina asked. Don't you keep feeling like Miss Lester's going to catch you smoking in the bathroom?
I never smoked in the bathroom, I said, scraping the bottom of the cereal bowl and wiping the baby's mouth with his bib. I'd never seen such efficient eating in my life.
Oh, that's right. Miss Goody Two Shoes. I forgot. You didn't do things like that.
Emelina smiled. She'd been at least as virtuous as I was in high school. The difference was she was popular. Virtue in a cheerleader is admirable, while in a wallflower, it's gratuitous.
Miss Goody Orthopedic Shoes, I said.
She hooted.
Why on God's green earth did you and Hallie wear those shoes? I never did ask. I figured the polite thing was just ignore them, like when somebody has something hanging out of their nose.
Thank you. We wore them because Doc Homer was obsessed with the bones of the foot.
Kinky old Doc, she said, stabbing a wooden spoon into a pot of boiled potatoes.
You have no idea.
He used to sit us down and give us lectures on how women destroy their bodies through impractical footwear.
I delivered his lecture, which Hallie and I used to ape behind his back.
Of the 200 bones in the human body, more than a quarter are in the foot. It is a more complicated instrument than an automobile transmission, and it is treated with far less consideration.
Emelina was laughing.
Really, you have to give him credit. All my mom ever told me was sit up straight, don't get pregnant, and wear a slip.
Doc Homer wasn't that great on pregnancy and underwear, I said. But Lord knows the Nolene girls were not going to have fallen arches.
Where'd you get those god-awful things from? Not the Hollywood shop, I know that.
Mail order.
No!
Swear to God. Hallie and I used to burn the catalogs in the fireplace when they came, but he'd still get those damn shoes. For the sizing, he'd draw around our feet on a piece of paper and then take all these different measurements. I expect I spent more time with Doc Homer getting my foot measured than any other thing. Emelina found this hilarious. I know she thought I was exaggerating, but I wasn't. In a way, we were grateful for the attention, but the shoes were so appalling. They affected our lives, the two of us differently. Hallie just gave up trying for image, while I went the route of caring too much. It was harder for me, being the first to break into junior high, then high school, in these shoes. I suffered first, and therefore more. I'm positive that was the whole reason I hardly ever had any dates in high school, I told Emelina. That's ridiculous, she said. The only reason boys didn't ask you out was because they thought you were too good for them. You were so smart. Why would you want to run with a Grace boy? That's what they thought. The meeting in the living room was beginning to break up. We lowered our voices automatically. No, I said solemnly. It was the shoes. It's a known fact. The day I left Grace, I bought a pair of gladiator sandals and my sex life picked right up. Emelina eventually remembered a letter for me she'd been carrying around a while. She'd stuck it in the diaper bag when she picked up the mail and then forgotten it, so it suffered more in its last 100 yards of delivery than it had in its previous 1,500 miles. Of course, it was from Hallie. I went home to read it, like a rat scurrying back to its hole with some edible prize. I settled into the living room chair, polished my glasses, and scowled at the postmark. Chiapas, near Mexico's southern border, only days after she left. That was a disappointment. Anything could have happened since then. I slid it open. Cody, dear, I've been driving the way you're supposed to here, like a bat out of hell. The wrong way out of hell, whenever that's possible. I'm getting the hang of outlawry. You'd be proud. I burned up the road till around La Cruz and then slowed down enough to enjoy the banana trees going by in a blur. The tropics are such a gaudy joke. People have to live with every other kind of poverty, but a fortune in flowers, growing out of every nook and cranny of anything. If you could just build an economy on flowers. I stayed in a house that had vanilla orchids growing out of the gutters and a banana tree coming up under the kitchen sink. I swear. There were some kind of little animals, too, like mongooses. You would know what they are. I'm happy to be in a jungle again. You know me. I'm always cheered by the sight of houseplants growing wild and 50 feet tall. I keep thinking about 626-BUGS and all those sad ladies trying to grow zebrinas in an arid climate. I wanted to take the coast highway as far as Nayarit, where it gets rugged, but I paid the price for that little adventure. Doc Homer would say, I paid a dollar for my shiny dime. I broke, not bent, but flat out busted an axle in Tuxpan, and spent 2 days waiting around while a man with a Fanta delivery truck and time on his hands brought in a new one from Guadalajara. The only hotel was a 2-story pension with a live band, that's a euphemism, on weekends. I spent the time mostly sitting on my balcony watching pelicans dive bomb the sea and remembering our trip to San Blas. Remember those pelicans? If you'd been there in Tuxpan, it would have been fun. I couldn't bring myself to do anything productive. There were people I could have talked to about crops and the refugee scene, but instead I spent one whole morning watching a man walk up the beach selling shrimp door to door. He had a pole over his shoulders, with the bucket of shrimp hung on one side, and on the other side, a plastic jug of water. Every time he sold a kilo of shrimp, he'd pour out that much water and drink it to balance the load. I watched him all the way down the bay and thought, I want to be like that. Not like the man selling shrimp, like his machine. To give myself over to utility with no waste. But I was useless lying around those 2 days. Saving my strength for what's ahead, I guess. I get more jumpy as I move south, like a compass needle or something. saw an awful lot of dead cropland in the interior, and I know it will be worse in Nicaragua. War brings out the worst in production agriculture. Tomorrow I cross the border, but it's hard to say where the border is.